Scripture this morning is found in Exodus chapter 33, verses 14 through 20. Exodus 33, 14 through 20. The Lord replied, "My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest." Then Moses said to him, "If your presence does not go with us, do not send us up from here. How will anyone know that you are pleased with me and with your people unless you go with us? What else will distinguish me and your people from all the other people on the face of the earth?" And the Lord said to Moses, "I will do the very thing you have asked, because I am pleased with you and I know you by name." Then Moses said, "Now show me your glory." And the Lord said, "I will cause all my goodness to pass in front of you, and I will proclaim my name, the Lord, in your presence. I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion." But he said, "You cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live."
Thank you, Ben.
There we go. Well, a number of years ago, there was a song that became rather popular in America, both on the Christian radio and as a worship song sung in churches. Speaking to God, the lyrics say, "I want to know you. I want to hear your voice. I want to know you more." But the song goes on from there with some rather shocking words. I mean, these are words that, quite frankly, ought to terrify the tie-dye right off a hippie. They say, "I want to touch you. I want to see your face. I want to know you more." Now, I understand what the song is trying to do, and what the song is trying to do is not a bad thing. It's promising that God has come near to us. It is proclaiming a desire for that. It's this urge to know and to have a relationship with God, not one that is me and that one way over there, but me and you on the same couch, so to speak, in relationship with each other. The words of that song are meant to reflect the same attitude of longing for God that is found in Psalm 84, verse 2. "My soul yearns, even faints for the Lord. My heart and my flesh cry out for the living God." And yet, when I read in the Bible about the greatness of God's glory, when I read in the Bible about God's holiness, something in me rebels against language that proclaims that it's okay, even a reasonable thing, to want to touch God or see his face. Compare that to the hymn we just sang, right? "In light inaccessible, hid from our eyes, thine angels adore thee, all veiling their sight." If you want a really good hymn on this, turn to number 17, and you read in verse 3 this line, how beautiful the sight of thee must be, thine endless wisdom, boundless power, and awful purity." In verse 4 of the same song, "Oh, how I fear thee, living God, with deepest, tenderest fears, and worship thee with trembling hope and penitential tears." You see, there's no glib lightness in a hymn like that, is there? There's instead the understanding that while God's holiness is good, it is also a terrible danger to us. His holiness is such that even holy angels must veil their faces in his presence. Now, do not misunderstand me. I love modern songs as well. I love the modern worship choruses. That song, "I Want to Know You More," I have nothing against it. It seizes upon a strong theme in the Bible, especially in the New Testament, that God has come near and wants to be known by us, and so we cry out to him, "We want to know you too." It's a good theme of the Bible. It's good news. It needs to be celebrated. However, if we sing such words without a proper understanding of the holiness, greatness, the glory of God, then we run to the terrible risk of making light of God's holiness God's holiness is not something that we can run into however we feel like it. We must approach God on his terms, not on our terms. And nor should we, in our desire to love God, nor should we ever think of him as something to be cuddled, like a kitty cat or a big fuzzy ball of love in the sky. That is not the God we serve. He is holy. And we need to understand him as such. In fact, without a good understanding of God's holiness, we will never really truly understand the goodness of the gospel of Jesus Christ that calls us into his presence and says, yes, I will reveal myself to you. God's holiness, by its nature, God's holiness makes him inaccessible to us. We cannot see him. We cannot get to him. We cannot touch him. He is beyond the highest heavens, and so how can we possibly get to him? I could not force my way into his throne room, even if I had all the powers of creation at my disposal. It's just plain not possible. And I would have more chance, honestly, of surviving for a full minute on the surface of the sun than I would have of surviving 1 second in the presence of a holy God. And yet the Bible also proclaims not just that God is holy, but that God is near to us. Jesus taught us to pray, "Our Father, which art in heaven." Right? He is in heaven. He is holy. He is great. He is glorious. He is still far beyond us in his nature. And yet, we are taught that God is our Father. He cares. He comes near and establishes a relationship with us. So he is by nature transcendent, high above, completely beyond, but he chooses to make himself imminent. He is unknowable, yet he has revealed himself. He is great, but he comes to us. He is so holy we could never get to him, but he chose to come to us. That's what we celebrate as we go toward that Christmas season, which I am sorry to tell you is coming upon us very, very quickly now. It's the great story of the Bible. And it's where we finish our study of Exodus. Today is our last study in the book of Exodus. And in it, we find that we need God, but God is far beyond our reach. But the gospel is that God, in his grace, comes near to us. Only if we will first understand our need, only if we will first then also understand God's holiness, will we appreciate how amazingly wonderful is the news that God has come near to his people and gives us grace. And only if we will understand how God came near his people in the Old Testament, in the Exodus, will we fully appreciate the surpassing greatness that we have in Jesus Christ, our Lord. First, we need God. That's where we start. After all that Moses had experienced to this point in Exodus, he had a firm understanding of the need, the real need of Israel. Israel was freed from slavery in Egypt. But they were not freed from slavery by a great strategy or force of arms or the ability to run fast. They were freed because God acted miraculously on their behalf. Israel was able to cross the Red Sea, but not because they built boats or built a bridge or were good swimmers. They crossed the sea through the intervention of God on their behalf. Israel had food in a desolate wilderness, but not because they were good hunters or remarkable farmers. They had food because God graciously granted it to them every single day. Israel had pure, clean water to drink in that dry and arid desert, but not because they brought water with them and not because they found it somewhere. They had water because God provided it for them in miraculous ways. Israel entered into covenant with God. They received his laws. They were given promises for a land that he would give them, but not because they deserved these things, not because they made themselves acceptable to God, not even because they sought those things at all. In fact, their actions throughout all of this showed that they deserved destruction and none of what God had given to them. They were given the covenant and the law and forgiveness for sins by the sheer overwhelming grace of God and by nothing else. And Moses saw all this. He learned the lesson. He's no dummy. And so Moses prays to God here in Exodus 33, and he's begging for God to go with his people. Ultimately, Israel's greatest need is not food or water or any other blessing that God might give to them, not even freedom from slavery. Yeah, we need such things for our physical bodies to work, to live. But the lesson of the Exodus is that we need God far more than we need those things that God might give to us. We need him. We need food for life, but we are not given life to eat. You know, we're not made alive so that we might eat. We were made to be with and serve God. We need him. So Moses recalls the commands and promises of God and presses God to give Israel their real need, what they truly need. He says, if you want me to lead, then you've got to lead. If you are pleased with me, then show me your ways so that I can continue to please you. If you are with your people, then remember that you have promised to be our God and go with us. Moses knows what God has been doing, and he knows the promises of God, and he claims those promises. And so, as was read for us in Exodus 33, in verse 14, God promises to go with his people. Moses is not content to leave it there, though. He's desperate. He's holding on to the promise God made with both hands, and he's demonstrating in this, the brute fact that he needs God. He says in verses 15 and 16, basically, if I can paraphrase it this way, he says, don't tease me now. If you don't go with us, we can't go anywhere. If you leave us, we are lost. Without you, we are, again, no better than any other nation. We're sinful and without hope. Without you, we have nothing good. God, go with us. And once again, Moses obtains the promise of God in verse 17. This desperation that Moses has, that ought to be our desperation too. Like Israel, we need God. We need him. Without God, our lives are wretched and poor and empty and pitiable and meaningless. Without God, humanity is pathetic. A ruined creature that is lost in sin and filth with destruction and everlasting shame, regret, judgment. Those are our only destinations if we are without God. Without God, we are the scum of the earth. Yay, right? How encouraging that is. We are capable only of enough good to demonstrate just how far our fall from grace had been. We have a need for God that nothing else will fill. It's not that we don't try. We try to fill that need all the time in so many ways. Our world is full of people who try to find meaning in life apart from God, in whom all meaning is found. And so we try sex, drugs, and rock and roll. We try fame and fortune and success and love and education. We try achievement of all kind. We try obtaining power and strength and luxury and excess, and yet we still cannot find meaning and satisfaction. It eludes us. Others go the opposite way. Instead of trying to get more, they actually try to do less. They reject the things of this world and choose simple lives. They own nothing, content themselves with no notoriety, spend all their time in meditation and living on one grain of rice per day and that kind of nonsense. But in the end, everyone ends up the same. No matter how much stuff we own or don't own, we can't seem to own enough or give away enough. No matter how many people love us, we always want more. Even the best education only ever really tells us how much we have yet to learn. The highs we get from drugs, other addictions along these lines, these leave us empty, needing the next high, leading nowhere. And ultimately, death is the great leveler, isn't it? What good is stuff that you can't keep after death? What use is knowledge if it passes away with you? The Rolling Stones stumbled onto real truth with their hit, right? I can't get no satisfaction. Too bad they left it there. A cry of desperation with no hope at all. We were made for God. We need God. St. Augustine knew it 1,600 years ago. He said, "You have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless till they find their rest in you." Kind of like a rolling stone, restless. We have no life on our own. We have no purpose on our own. We have nothing good without God. He is the source. From him comes everything that is good in life. To be separated from him, then, is to be separated from life. That means death. That means pain and judgment and suffering and endless regret. Like Moses, we cry out to God. If you do not go with us, then we are lost and we have nothing in this world without you. We need him. We need him like that, but we have a great big problem. Remember that holiness of God? He is holy, and we are not. We need him, but he's beyond our reach. Sinful people cannot just dwell in the presence of a holy God. Moses gets a great lesson in God's holiness. Having received God's promises that he will lead the Israelites into the promised land, Moses goes a step further. Now show me your glory. Let's understand what is happening here. Moses is not simply a curious cat trying to figure out, now let me see what you really look like, God, because I'm kind of curious how tall you are. That's not what Moses is doing here. He's not simply trying to satisfy a spiritual longing of curiosity. He is instead asking for a demonstration of the promise that God made to him. God made a promise, and Moses is saying, okay, demonstrate it. I'll go with you. And Moses says, okay, then show up. Be here. Put your promise into effect. To some extent, God has to deny this request of Moses. Moses asks to see God, and God says, okay, wait a minute. Tell you what I'll do. I'll show you my goodness, and I'll proclaim my name in your presence. I'll show you the richness of my mercy given in free grace, but I cannot show you my face. You cannot see the full glory of God, Moses. That would be the undoing of you. God denies Moses' request, at least in that way, not because he's shy, not because God doesn't want to be seen, but for Moses' own good. Have you ever been in the presence of true, raw power? Perhaps you've worked near a smelter or another kind of hot furnace like that. And those kinds of furnaces, they have a heat vent, as it were, where all the heat goes out, and you would know the immense energy, the pure heat that that type of furnace creates. Would you ever put your hand over that heat vent? What would happen to your hand if it went over that heat vent? You wouldn't have a hand anymore. You would not put your face over that heat vent. None of us would go walking into a nuclear reactor. Do you understand what I'm saying? Who could possibly survive in the face of that kind of power? Now, keep that in mind and remember that the power and glory of God is infinitely greater than even a nuclear reactor. I mean, a smelter can refine iron from the ore using great heat, but it is God who called the iron ore into existence by the power of his word. A nuclear reaction could power or destroy a city. But God created and can destroy the whole universe. Kind of puts things in perspective, doesn't it? We cannot stand in the presence of the limited power that is under our control. How much less can we stand in the unlimited presence of the God who is not in our control? That's why God says, Moses, you cannot have everything you request, but I'll show you what you can see. So God takes Moses and puts him in the cleft of a rock. Shall we read that? I'm going to pick it up again at verse 19. And the Lord said, I will cause all my goodness to pass in front of you, and I will proclaim my name, the Lord, in your presence. I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. But, he said, you cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live. Then the Lord said, there is a place near me where you may stand on a rock. When my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft in the rock and cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will remove my hand, and you will see my back, but my face must not be seen. Okay, Moses, I'll show you what you can see. I'm going to take you, and I'm going to put you into a cleft of a rock. Moses is not going to be able to see much out of that cleft rock. It's just going to be a narrow field of view. And then God's going to even cover that with his hand, completely block Moses' field of view entirely, preventing him from seeing, protecting him from the overwhelming power of God's holiness, removing his hand only when the presence has passed. All that Moses could see of God was the back, a momentary glimpse of fading glory. There was no way that Moses could see God in his fullness. Such a thing would be death for Moses. So this is what he could see, an afterglow, an around-the-corner protected almost glimpse of God. We still today sometimes catch those echo reminders of glory, don't we? Consider the ocean. I know the sea. I can tell you all kinds of facts about it. I can even understand something about its vastness. I've gone swimming in the ocean many, many times. I've seen it many, many times. But all the same, I do not really get the vastness and greatness of the sea. Do you know what I'm talking about? You can learn about it in a book, but there's something overwhelming about being at the sea. It's far beyond the scope of our understanding. A number of years ago, Miriam and I went on a cruise. And when you pull into the harbor, when you see those cruise ships, you're overwhelmed by them. They are huge. They are cities on the sea. They are very big. And then you go exploring in the boat and you're thinking, we are going to bounce and rattle around this ship all this week. It's great. Huge thing. Just takes up city blocks. It's amazing. And then it goes to sea. And out in the sea, that ship begins to feel a little bit smaller. If you've been on a cruise, you know what I'm talking about. You look out one way, and then you look out the other way, and you see, I see nothing. To every horizon, I see nothing. This ship is one tiny, tiny, tiny speck on this really big ocean. I could not possibly know all the depths of the sea. I could not possibly get my mind around its staggering size. It overwhelms me. So why should I think I can get God's holiness? If I cannot comprehend the fullness of the sea, how can I comprehend the one who made the sea and measures it out in the hollow of his hand? I also know space. I go outside and I look up at the heavens. I can recognize planets. I can identify them. I can recognize stars and name constellations. I can chart their movements across the sky. I know facts about space. I can define terms like leap year, you know? These big terms about space, but at the same time, I do not comprehend space. I am so small, and it is so big. I cannot really get my mind around the limitless reaches of space and the staggering distances between stars and planets overwhelms me. But if I cannot comprehend the fullness of space, how can I comprehend the one who made and fills space? How can I possibly understand the greatness of God that the vastness of space cannot contain? Psalm 19 says, "The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. He is holy. He is exalted far higher and greater than we could imagine. He is pure and infinite and great and strong. The bad news is that we are sinful and limited and small and weak. We were created for God. We need God, but God is holy, and now we are not. Our God is a refining fire, and if we were to be tested in the fire of his justice, nothing would survive. There would be no remainder of me if that was all there was. And so we have a real problem. We need him, but we can't get to him. And if that situation were to remain unchanged, then the best we could hope for is a brief, over-the-shoulder, almost glimpse of the fading glory of God. God is holy and we are not, yet God, in his grace, comes to his people." This is the good news that the Bible proclaims, not just in the New Testament, but throughout. Turn to the end of the book of Exodus, chapter 40. I want to read verses 33 through 35. It says this, Start in verse 33. "Then Moses set up the courtyard around the tabernacle and altar and put up the curtain at the entrance of the courtyard. And so Moses finished the work. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses could not enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled upon it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle." In all the chapters between chapter 33 and chapter 40, we have the account of Moses, according to God's direction, building the tabernacle. Here at the end of the book, the tabernacle is set up, and the glory of God fills the tabernacle. The people needed God to go with them, but they are so unworthy of coming into his presence. And so God, in his grace and in his mercy, he chooses to come to them. The tabernacle is built to really convey an amazing message, which is the holy God dwells with his people. But this holiness cannot be taken lightly. Just as Moses was hidden in a rock, so also the glory of God is hidden behind the tabernacle's veils. Not hidden, not protected in such a way because God needed protection from the people, but because the people could not survive in the presence of holiness. With this appearance, the glory of God in the tabernacle coming, Exodus comes to a very fitting conclusion. Israel had begun the book in Egypt, a people belonging to Pharaoh. They were enslaved, they were oppressed. Now they are on the way to the promised land, with God himself dwelling in their presence, having freed them and giving them abundant grace. Abundant, abundant grace. It had been God's intention all along to bring the people to himself. It's not just about a land. He was bringing them to himself. He knew their need. Not fundamentally freedom and their own place to live. He wanted to meet their need. And nothing, not the might of Egypt, not the harshness of the desert, not the reluctance of Moses, not even the great unbelief and sin of his people could prevent God from achieving his purpose and keeping his promises. Through the trials, by means of power, by means of discipline, and by a great amount of grace, Israel is now the people of God, dwelling with their God. That's where Exodus leaves us. It's a great place to end. But let's finish with this thought. As good as that was, and it was very good, it was still entirely inadequate. After all, even though God dwelt near his people, in the midst of them, in the center of the camp, they were still separate from him. No one could just walk into the presence of God. God dwelt in the tabernacle, and the tabernacle in the middle of the camp was protected by the priests. Only the priest could go into the tent. And no one, not even the priest, could go into the Holy of Holies except that one high priest, only once a year for, you know, a few moments, get in and skedaddle because the glory of God is in there, and that's dangerous. Moses was as close to God as any human being could get, and we read in chapter 34, verses 29 through 35, that when he would come out after spending time with God in the tent, his face would shine. He would have a radiant face. It was a reflection of the glory that he had seen while he was in there. But that glory would fade. His face reflected the holiness of God, but he himself, Moses, was not made holy through it. Do you know the surprising mystery of God? The surprising truth is that we have something far, far better than Moses and the people of Israel in the desert. They had the tabernacle. They had God in a pillar of cloud leading them. But what do we have? 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 17 and 18 say this. Now the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. And we, who with unveiled faces all reflect the Lord's glory, are being transformed into his likeness with ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit. You see what Paul's doing there? Paul had said that there was indeed glory that came to the Israelites. He talked about that earlier in the chapter. But that glory faded. It could not last. But now, God no longer lives in a tent near us. God lives through his Spirit in us. Because of Jesus Christ, our glory does not fade then. It is ever increasing. We need God, but God is holy. We can't get to him. And what happened? God, through his grace, came to us, not in a tent any longer with glory hidden and fading, but in our hearts, having been made holy so that we can indeed stand in his presence. The cross does this for us. In the cross, the veil is torn, rent asunder from top to bottom. God inviting us no longer outside the Holy of Holies, but into the Holy of Holies. And then he sends his Spirit into our hearts to give us his light and life and glory. How much better is it that we have than what they have? Hebrews chapter 7 puts it this way. Jesus, our high priest, is able to save completely those who come to God through him because he always lives to intercede for them. Such a high priest meets our need. One who is holy, blameless, pure, set apart from sinners, exalted above the heavens, he sacrificed for our sins once for all when he offered himself. And Hebrews 4 says, Let us then, approach the throne of God with confidence so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. Do you know how shocked Moses would have been to hear anyone say, we can approach the throne of God with confidence? Why? Because we have a high priest who offered the perfect sacrifice. Finally, we have what Moses only dreamed of. Show me your glory. And he does. Show me your glory. And we see Jesus. This is the glory of God, proclaimed to the world. And it is seen increasingly through us. that's what God is doing in this world. Will you join him in it? We're going to sing Fairest Lord Jesus in just a moment. It's number 48. We're going to sing that. We focus our eyes on Christ, who is the great chief example of what it means that the glory of God has come near. But before we sing that, as we pray and transition to that, I would invite you once again to offer your heart to Christ, to offer yourself to God. We often think, oh, if only I lived in the time of Moses, if only I seen what Daniel saw, if only I could be someone who walked alongside of Elijah or something else along these lines. We have something so much greater, so much better. Don't miss what God is doing through his church now today, because we're wishing for the fading glory of yesterday. You understand what I'm saying? Let's offer ourselves anew to God to join him what he is doing today.